A recent census reported that about 86 million single people live in the United States. As people get married later, as the divorce rate climbs, and more couples choose to live together instead of getting married, the number of single individuals is increasing fast. In 1970, 36% of American adults were single. Today, the figure is closer to 44%. Married couples with kids, which used to be the norm, now make up only about 25% of our population. Even for those who marry, singleness makes up a large portion of their life, either at the front end or the back end of life. Suppose you are married at age 26, that your spouse dies when you are 70 and you live to be 82. You would have been married for 44 years, but you had been single for 38 years. Are those single years less important than your married years? In our church, about 54% of our members are single. Yet, we don't talk about singleness enough. The church often doesn't know how to address the issue. Most preachers, like myself, are married, and we feel we lack the credibility to talk about it. Most Christians would say that we were created to be married, that marriage is normal. Singles are incomplete or abnormal. Maybe we haven't come right out and said that, but we definitely have implied it. I understand where the assumption comes from. In Genesis, it says that it's not good for man to be alone. We say that means everyone ought to be married. Couldn't it mean that all human beings need deep, caring relationships and can't live in isolation? Does it really teach that everybody is called to be married? Need I mention that Jesus was a single adult, and so were his best friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. John the Baptist was single. We don't know if Paul was ever married, but if he was, either he had divorced or his wife had died, because when he wrote his letters in the New Testament, he was single. This morning, we're going to look at what Paul had to say to single people in the church at Corinth. He addresses three different groups of singles. To each of them, he says pretty much the same thing. It's best not to marry, but it's okay if you do. First, to marry or not. The first group he talks to is what we're going to call the unmarried. He addresses them and he calls them virgins. He's most likely talking to young people who are of marriageable age but have never married. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, starting at verse 25, going to verse 28, it says, "Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who, by the mercy of the Lord, is trustworthy. I like then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you." Paul qualifies his advice by saying that this isn't a command from the Lord, but his own opinion or judgment. That doesn't mean that we can take it or leave it. He is trustworthy. We need to take it seriously as we do all Scripture. Paul's advice is clear. It's best to remain as you are. If you're not married, stay single. If you're married, you should stay married. Now, someone could hear that and conclude, well, then if I don't remain as I am and I do get married, I'll be in sin. So Paul is quick to add that if you do marry, you have not sinned. Remember earlier in this chapter, he even told single people that it is better to get married than to burn with passion. In other words, if you can't control your sexual passions, it is better to get married than to stay single and have sex. Marriage isn't a sin, but sex apart from marriage is. So if you're an unmarried person and you can stay single, go for it. But if you really want to get married, then that's okay too. You still may have to wait and trust the Lord, but it's okay to want marriage and move in that direction. And then he talks to the second group. The second group that Paul addresses here is those who are engaged. In verses 36 through 38, he says to them, if anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably towards the virgin he is engaged to, and if his passions are too strong and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He is not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion, but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does better. Depending on what translation you have, these verses are interpreted differently. See, I'm using here this morning the NIV because I think that's the best way to understand these verses. The NIV takes this to refer to an engaged couple, what an engaged man ought to do in relation to his fiancée. But the New American Standard translates these verses like this, but if a man thinks he is acting unbecomingly towards his virgin daughter, if she should be a full age, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let her marry. So the New American Standard Bible understands this as referring to whether a father should give his virgin daughter away in marriage. So I think it makes more sense here that this is an engaged couple. People got engaged quite young back then, and often it was years before they were married. In these situations, his advice is clear. Once again, he expresses his opinion that it is better not to get married. He even gives the engaged man a way out. If he feels in his own mind it's right not to marry, or if he's not under compulsion, which probably means that there was no prior marriage contract which obligated him to marry her, or if he's in control of his own will, which may mean that he was not a slave and not being required by his master to marry, if these things are the case, he didn't have to go through with the marriage. But once again, he's quick to point out that there may be some good reasons for an engaged man to go ahead with the marriage. If he's acting improperly towards her, that is, if he's not controlling his passions, if he is getting along in childbearing years, or if he feels for some reason that he ought to marry her, that it is the right thing to do, then they should get married. And Paul makes it clear, this is not sinning. The couple is doing what is right. The third group he addresses is single for a different reason. They were widows. There were many widows there in the ancient world. Here's what he has to say to them in 39 through 40. He says, a wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I also have the Spirit of God. First, he makes it clear that when a woman's husband dies, she is not bound to marry to the marriage any longer. She is free to remarry. But it's important that the man she marries belongs to the Lord. So she is not free to marry just anyone. She is to marry a believer. Of course, that is a rule of thumb for anybody who's a Christian who's getting married. But he still believes it's best for her not to marry again. He even believes that her singleness comes from the Spirit of God. So essentially, Paul says the same thing to all three of these groups. It's best not to marry, but it is okay if you do. Being single should not be considered a diminished state of existence. It doesn't mean you're a failure or that you're cursed. A single person has the same value as any other member of the body, but you're still left with the question of why Paul holds the opinion that singleness is preferable, especially since God created marriage in the first place. The reason that it is easier for single people to single-mindedly serve the Lord. Your most important quality is not your marital status, but your serving. So single-mindedly serving the Lord. In verse 26, Paul spoke of some present crisis. Scholars differ about what this was referring to. Some think that it was some crisis in Corinth at that time, like a famine or some impending war. Others think that he's speaking of the tribulation that would precede the second coming of the Lord. Jesus had even predicted the fall of Jerusalem within the lifetime of that generation, which would take place quite soon, about 70 AD. To me, that makes the most sense in view of what he says in verses 29 through 35. But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on, those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things, of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. Paul says that since the time is short, it's best not to be engrossed in the things of this world. See, that's hard enough to do when you're single, but it's even harder when you're married. A married person can easily get wrapped up in the things of the world, but this world is passing away. Our focus should be on what lasts and on pleasing the Lord. A married person is concerned about the needs of their spouse. The reality is that sometimes that can distract you from pleasing the Lord. If you're single, you can be more single-minded. Marriage is a gift, but consider the realities of being married and having a family. So when I left my parents' home, basically all my possessions could fit in one little suitcase. But when I got married, the first time we moved from Jennings, Louisiana, we rented a little U-Haul truck and basically got all of our stuff in that one little truck. A couple years later, we moved to Lake Charles, Louisiana, and we had even a bigger truck. And when we went to Bible college, we had tons of stuff, and we sold off just about everything until we could fit just about everything into our cars and one little trailer that we took with us. Then a few years later, when we get ready to leave, after we established a house there in West Virginia, we had to have, again, a big truck to move out of there. We just keep getting bigger, and then today, when we get ready to move, we sometimes have to make two trips with the biggest truck that we can rent in order to get all of our stuff. I always thought when you bought a sofa, when you got married, it would last you all your life, and found out that's not true at all. A married couple told me one time that they had their kids about 5 years apart, so that they figured that one would graduate, go to college, and then they would have it paid off by the time the 5 years along came the next child. And it worked out pretty good for them, and everything was working, and they get ready for the second child to go to college, and guess what? The first child gets married. And he said it was like paying for a fifth year of college. And all these things make married people worried and anxious, and one worrying about how they're going to make those payments and make sure their children have the best. And meanwhile, I'm also trying to lead a church. It's harder to single-mindedly serve the Lord with so much going on. Now, don't get me wrong. I would not trade my wife and our families for anything. I love having my nieces and nephews come and spend the summers with us and all the things that that brings with it. My wife and all my nieces and nephews, my brothers and sisters, moms, dads, all those brings us, gives us more freedom and joy than I ever deserved. If I want to go to Austin, it's not a problem. I just get up and I go. If I have to go out several times a week and for meetings, that's okay. Personally, I think I'm a lot more effective being married than I would be if I was single. But Paul says that when you're married, there are a lot of things that distract you and eat up your time. If I were single, I wouldn't have two cars to maintain. I could be out every night meeting with people. I could read and study more. I could give more money away and spread the gospel and feed the poor. Now, it's important to add here that just because you're single doesn't mean that you're going to occupy yourself with these things. As a single person, you are going to be tempted as well to, just like anyone else, to accumulate the possessions of this world, to fill your time with things that are not eternal, but at least you'll have more opportunity to be undivided in your pursuits and have a simpler life. Maybe that's what Paul means when he says in verse 40 that widows will be happier if they stay single. So what does all this mean for the single adult today? Let me just give you a few guidelines based on what we've learned from God's word. First, view your single state as a gift and a calling. Again, verse 7 says, "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." See, a gift is something that God has given us out of his grace. In verse 17, he says, "Singleness is a calling, reminding us that our marital status is not primarily about us and our choices, it's about God. He's the one doing the calling." I heard preachers address the question, how do I know if I have the calling and the gift from God? The answer I normally hear is that if being single is hard for you, if you kind of like it, then it's probably a calling that God has given you. There is some wisdom in that. The calling that you have often fits with you and with the things that you enjoy. See, I'm not called to be a musician. I'm not called to be a drum player, play the drums, play the guitar. I have zero ability in those areas, and it would be impossible for me to enjoy it. And here this morning, it would be almost impossible for you to enjoy it if I tried. But many of us are called to things that are not easy for us. See, I'm called to be a preacher and a teacher, but I've often found that to be agonizing work. And most married people, whether gifting equals ease, they may feel they've been called to marriage, but few married couples will say that marriage was easy. Lauren Winter suggests in her book, Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity, that we shouldn't fixate on the long-time call to singleness. Some people might be called to that, but most people are called to singleness just for a spell, even if it is a long spell. If you're single right now, you're called right now to be single. You're called to live the single life as robustly and as gospel-conforming as you possibly can. The problem comes with the assumption that this is somehow a lifelong calling. Panic singles fear that they might have the gift forever. But think about other callings. At one time, I had a calling to be a youth minister. And it's not one that I have for my entire life. There came a day where I made a transition from youth ministry to senior ministry. It was my calling, but age and abilities and time made the change where it was not a lifelong calling for me. You might be called and gifted to be a stay-at-home mother of small children right now, but it won't be your lifelong calling because your children are going to grow up. It makes sense to view your singleness that way as well. Embrace your situation by faith, that this is what God has for you now, but realize that could also change. If you have that gift now, live with excellence now. Don't wait to really live. Don't live in a kind of holding pattern. Get out of neutral. Put your heart into high quality, single-minded living for Christ. You have time and energy that you wouldn't have otherwise. Take that time and put it into positive, constructive, long-term ministry. Someday, God's going to ask you, what did you do with the time that I gave you? We also need to cultivate deep, caring relationships. Consider the relationship between four single adults, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, and Jesus. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were siblings who lived together, and their home was a frequent and comfortable resting place for Jesus to come and to be with them. It was his home away from home while he was on the road. When Jesus learned that Lazarus was sick, some folks came to him and said, "The one you loved is sick." There are two main words for love in the Greek New Testament. One is phileo, and it means a deep, caring friendship. See, that's the word used here. Later in the story, a different word is used. It says Jesus not only loved Lazarus, Jesus loved Mary and Martha. The word there is agape. See, that's a deeper, more intimate word, a word that involves a commitment. Jesus wasn't only a caring friend of Lazarus, he also unselfishly devoted himself to the welfare of Mary and Martha. When Lazarus died, you find Jesus and the woman who loved each other with agape, weeping together by the graveside. Imagine these people, arms around each other, praying together, weeping profusely, wiping each other's tears in the firm embrace that agape implies. Four Christian singles bound together in agape. See, they had the kind of deep sharing and caring in the relationship that matches and maybe exceeds what a lot of married people have. If you're single, cultivate relationships with people who will pray for you, who will correct you when you get off track, who will become a buffer to you when the rough edges of life rub you raw, who will support you when you take on large responsibilities, who will listen to your doubts, to your fears, to your questions, to your concerns, who will celebrate you when there is joy. It's not good for anyone to be alone. Open up to other caring relationships. Also, you need to stay pure. See, the relationship of Jesus to Mary, Martha, and Lazarus involved phileo, and it involved agape. But there's also another kind of love in the Greek language, and it's called eros, sexual love. Their love didn't involve eros. They were chaste. Part of the calling as a single person is to chastity. See, chastity is a commitment to have sex only in the context of marriage. See, it's best to see chastity in the context of Jesus' call to take up our crosses daily and follow him. All of us in this community we call church are called to the daily disciplines of denying ourselves. But for each of us, that may look different depending on who we are and the circumstances we have been called to live under. All of these variables require us to deny ourselves in some way. Chastity is one of those ways, but it's not the only way. Married people have to take up their crosses too. As a community, we need to help one another carry our crosses. Lauren Winter writes, "Like most spiritual disciplines, chastity is better practiced in a community than alone. It's not enough for individual Christians to be chaste. The church must be a community that works towards chastity, a community whose structures and rhythms make chastity seem more plausible and attainable. Much like Alcoholics Anonymous, we should create a place where radical change of behavior makes sense because it sustains relationships that are organized around the vision of changed lives. The church, too, needs to be a community where chaste behavior makes sense, where people commit to a shared vision of lives transformed by the gospel. And then we need to be cautious about, but open to, marriage. If you're disappointed, unhappy, and frustrated with your present state, you'd be vulnerable to an unwise and unhappy marriage. Marriage was never intended to be a cure-all. Singleness is better than a bad marriage. Don't even get into a position where you consider marrying an unbeliever. So be cautious about marrying, but also be open and willing to risk and change. God often sends us out on risky ventures of faith where we're completely out of our comfort zones. Two of my heroes in this regard is Ruth and Boaz. If you read their love story in the Old Testament, you'll see what I mean. One thing I've learned from their story is that God uses human initiatives to accomplish his will. Ruth took the initiative and found Boaz down in the threshing floor. Boaz, who knew who she was and that she was a woman of excellence, was willing to step up the plate and move out of his comfort zone to marry her. If you're single and long to be married, don't sit back and do nothing and pass it off as faith. I especially encourage men to get over the passivity, step up, and pursue godly women, treating them with the care and the respect that they deserve. And lastly, my advice from these texts is this: value the single person. Let me just say one last thing, and this is to the whole church, not just the singles. The church needs to learn how to value the single person. Perhaps you were surprised when I said that 54% of those who are here on a Sunday morning are single. We must learn not to think of the church as a bunch of families, but as one family, the church family. We need to develop more sensitivity towards single people. We need to examine some of the previous assumptions and stereotypes that lead us to make hurtful comments like, "Have you met anyone yet?" Parents make them. Relatives make them. Fellow church members make them. Don't say and do things that you might find offensive if you were in their shoes. We need to integrate singles into the full fellowship of the church. Yes, there is a place for specialized ministries for singles, just like there is for married people. But these should never be a substitute for integration into the full life of the church fellowship. If you're single, get into other ministries. Pray with people. Serve with people. Study with people. Don't isolate yourself. Those of you who are not single, do whatever you can to open doors in your group and in your family. Let me introduce someone to you. His name is John Stott. Perhaps you've heard of him. He's wrote many books. Many would say he was one of the leading Christian thinkers, statesmen, writer, Bible teacher of the 20th century. In 2005, Time magazine called him one of the 100 most influential people on the planet today. Stott died in 2011. What many people don't know about John Stott is that he never married, though according to his biography, he came close on two occasions. If you could ask how he was able to accomplish so much, he would say that with the responsibility of a family, he could have never have written, he could have never have traveled, he could never have ministered in the way that he did. The Church of Jesus Christ needs more men and women like John Stott. He epitomizes something Andrew Farmer says in his book, The Rich Single Life. I'll leave you with this challenge. Undivided devotion to the Lord is the essence of biblical identity for the single adult. It is rooted in the sovereignty of a God who places people in appropriate situations for the best possible reasons. It is steeped in the love of a God who uses even the most difficult of situations for the greatest possible benefit. It is sustained by the wisdom of a God whose timing is perfect and whose guidance is sure. If you are a Christian, don't despise the state in which you have been called Live in the gift of your singleness for as long as you have that gift. And whether or not God ever ordains the prospect of marriage in your life, bring faith for the present and hope for the future, because there is much to be done. Who better to set a hand to the task than you?